person. And she also has a wonderful son. And so I would like for you to meet Susan B, who is formerly from California and is now on the East Coast. Susan, it's all yours.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks for inviting me to speak at this meeting. I'm Susan. I'm a compulsive overeater. How long do I have, Joe?
You have 45 to 50 minutes.
Ha! Oh my God. Okay, I can tell the really long story. I was born. As Joe said, I was originally from Los Angeles. I came into OA in Los Angeles. I wasn't born there, but I grew up in LA. And I come from a Jewish family. And I only say that because there's a lot of stuff around food. Culturally, there's a lot of stuff around food, but certainly not everyone who's Jewish is a compulsive overeater or has had weight problems. But in my family, all the weight problems were on my mom's side. None of my cousins or relatives on my dad's side seemed to have any problems with weight or compulsive eating. It used to really make me angry that I took after my mother's side of the family. It stands to reason. The story, there's a story my aunt tells about me when I was less than 3 years old, because I left Chicago when I was three. My parents had side-by-side duplexes. And so because they, were right next door to each other and there were basements, they put a door in the basement so that we could go back and forth to each other's places without having to go outside when it was snowing. And so my aunt says I used to have dinner at home and then I'd go down to the basement, go through to her house and come up and have dinner with them. So I think I probably was born a compulsive overeater. My first binge that I remember was at about age seven. I don't remember why. I just remember that I broke into my piggy bank. I took all the money out of it. I rode my bike up to a corner candy store and I hid to eat it. Now that tells me a lot about, my disease and how far back it goes. And I ate it all, but I was in a place where nobody could see me. I didn't want anyone to see me. So there's always been a lot of issues in my family around how one looks. So I was told I was fat from a very young age. When I look at pictures of myself, I wasn't. I had a little belly. I have come to realize that that's the way I'm built. I've done much in my life to try to get rid of it, but it just seems to want to stay there. So, I finally have accepted that that is the way I am built. It's just how my body is. But the message was always I wasn't thin enough. I grew up feeling not good enough. I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. I felt like people didn't like me. I really wanted to try and figure out from as really almost as far back as I can remember what it was you wanted from me so I could give it to you so you would like me. And life doesn't work that way. So, went to school. I had some friends, but I was never part of the popular crowd. High school was a very social, large. I graduated high school in 1966, and I was part of the baby boomers. And so our graduating class, and that was by a semester, not a year, was 1,200 people. It was a lot of people. And there were social clubs in my high school, and I wasn't a part of that. And again, it was just like I never could figure out where did I fit, and because I didn't feel like I fit anywhere. And I like to say that when I came into OA, that the extent of my self-esteem was that I felt like I would be pretty if I would lose weight. So I graduated high school in 1966, and on August 2nd, 1966, I attended my first OA meeting. I went because my sister said to me, and I have a sister who's 6 years older than I am. She called me on the phone and she said, Susie, I found the answer. I wasn't even sure what she was talking about. And then she started and she said, and you and mommy have to go. And so she told me about OA. She had been going to OA in the San Fernando Valley, and I was living in West LA. So my mother and I went to a meeting together. It was a Wednesday night, That meeting still exists, which is an absolute miracle. It's 56 years ago. It moved from where it was to Palms Park, and it became, you know, the Wednesday night Palms Park meeting. I was 17. I hadn't turned 18 yet. And, it was just another place where I really felt like I didn't fit in. I was the only young person. Everybody else was really old, at least 27. And, the next youngest person was 10 years older than I was. And I don't remember a lot about that meeting. I remember the room kind of vaguely. I kind of remember the feel. I remember somebody handed me a gray sheet. For those of you who don't know what a gray sheet is, that's okay. You don't need to. But it was a structured food plan. And they told me to find a sponsor who had what I wanted. So I found this woman. She was about 10 years older than me. She was about 5'2", had blonde hair and blue eyes. And she looked like the cheerleaders that I'd gone to high school with. So that was what I wanted. Now I was 5'5", so I don't know how I figured I could get to be 5'2" or have blue eyes since I have brown eyes. I mean, I could always have blonde hair if I dyed it, but you know, that was what I thought would make me happy, you know, lose weight and look like her. And, you know, I struggled from the very beginning with abstinence. I had it, I didn't have it, you know. Things were very, and this is my judgment, I get that. So please take what you like and leave the rest. Things were very rigid back then. If you had this piece of paper that had what you should eat and how much of it you should eat and when you should eat it, and you varied from it in any way, shape, or form, you broke your abstinence. That was considered breaking your abstinence. So, you know, it took me a long time to realize this, but the truth of it was I really wanted to eat. Can we mention specific foods? Okay, I wanted to eat the chocolate chip cookies, but they weren't on that sheet. So I would have my one cup of green beans, which was, you know, whatever. And then I would take an extra tablespoon and put it on top. And then they said, you broke your abstinence. It was like, whoopee, I can go have the cookies. So that was how I used the gray sheet. You know, I used it as a way, as an excuse to actually binge, which is what I really wanted to do. I've done all kinds of different kinds of eating. You know, I've been a binge eater, I've been a grazer. Some of my best eating was after I came to OA, when I heard other people talk about their history. So I've never tried that before. You're supposed to try what the recovery things, but I was trying the other things. About a year after I came in, I met my first husband. He made an Al-Anon or an Alateen 12-step call on me. I still live with my parents. I was 19 years old. And Roseanne was my mother's sponsor for that period of time in the mid-60s. And, you know, I don't know that we really understood anonymity that well back then, because I went to her and I told her that my mom was drinking and she was following me around the house, yelling at me. And if I'd go in my bedroom and close and lock the door, she'd yell at me through the door. And so Roseanne suggested that I go to Al-Anon. And I only mention this because it's how I met my first husband. So I went to Al-Anon. Again, one more time, I felt like I didn't fit in. I was not married to someone. I was young. They were all, you know, talking about husbands. But some nice woman said to me, you should try Alateen. A young man has started a meeting in Brentwood on Thursday nights, and I can give you his number. So she gave me his number, and I called the next day, and his mom answered the phone, and I told her about my mom, and she said, oh, she sounds a lot like me. And I remember thinking, why would anyone admit that to a total stranger? Anyway, I met my first husband. We got, you know, on that next, that was a Saturday. I met him on Sunday. We got engaged on Tuesday, same week. Wow is right. He told me he loved me. I was afraid, and I've seen this in my life in so many other areas too. I was afraid if I didn't say yes to this person who loved me, I'd never find anyone else who would ever love me. And I can remember just it really breaks my heart to think about this, but I remember sitting in my bedroom in front of my vanity. So I had a mirror, and he was standing in the doorway behind me. And I looked at him in the mirror and I said, "Why do you love me?" And, you know, it breaks my heart that I felt that way. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what I was. I didn't know what I was capable of. And I married this man who was a typical, I think in some ways, child of a very heavy duty alcoholic. His father was a pretty low bottom alcoholic. His mother was a pretty low bottom Al-Anon. So basically that meant he was pretty much ignored most of his growing up years. So he was a drug addict himself. He turned into, in my opinion, and I know I'm not supposed to judge other people, but doesn't stop me, an alcoholic. He was a pathological liar. He had a lot of serious problems. So I married him. I got pregnant 2 months after we got married. And my first son was born 11 months after we got married. That's the son Joe speaks of, who just turned 55. Hard to believe. What happened, you know, I got married, I wore a size 10 wedding dress. I think I weighed 125 pounds. 2 months later, I weighed 150. And when I got pregnant with my first son, I actually, during the course of that pregnancy, after he was born, I had lost like 15 pounds. And I subconsciously thought I'd found the answer to my problem, my weight problem. The problem with that is you end up with a baby at the end that you have to take care of and support. But I did it again. I actually did want to have a second child. I didn't want children to be far apart because my sister and I were far apart in age. We're 6 years difference. And I wanted my kids to be close. So, you know, I had my kids 22 months apart, two boys. I wanted girls. You know, God has not given me what I want in a lot of ways, but God has given me way more than I ever could have imagined for the most part. So I had these two kids. I was struggling with abstinence. I was coming to meetings. I was not coming to meetings. I'd come back to meetings to see how y'all were doing. Y'all were doing great. I wasn't doing so great. When my husband and I separated, I was just shy of my 25th birthday. And I had these two little kids. I had no skills. I had no college degree. I had to find an apartment. I had to find daycare. I had to find a job. It was a very difficult time. And part of what was so difficult for me was that I wouldn't admit that it was difficult. So people would say, "How are you doing?" I'd say, "Oh, fine," when I really wasn't. And I think I got fired from my first three jobs after I got separated and then divorced from my husband. And a lot of it was related to my eating. And I was much more interested in what was in my drawer than I was in doing the job that they had hired me to do. And so I came, you know, I came back to OA. I think it was, you know, like for good. I never left permanently, but I mean, like I really committed again in, I think it was 1974, something like that. I can remember I had also gotten sober, and I was going to an AA meeting on Tuesday nights in Westwood. And that was one night I had a babysitter for my kids. And I can remember getting in the car, and there, you know, there's a way I drive and where I would turn left on Olympic to go to the AA meeting, but I turned right. And I ended up at Crescent Heights and Olympic, which was a very large meeting. And they had a beginner's meeting before the main meeting. And the main meetings were 2 hours. So it probably was like 3 hours worth of meetings, a lot of meeting. And I walked in the door, and standing up in front of the room, and I was standing in the back, was a woman I had met in AA, and she and I had stood around the refreshments table talking about how AA didn't work. And there were a lot of us in AA who'd say, you know, you were either told, you can work on any problem in AA, you know, just use the steps, you know, or OA doesn't work. You know, it's kind of, but she was talking that night about how, I don't remember how she exactly worded it, but for me, what it was this is exactly how the obsession works. She said, it's like a little man is standing on your shoulder, holding a gun to your head saying, if you don't eat the fill in the blank, whatever it is for you. For me at that point, it was chocolate cake. If you don't eat that, I'm going to pull the trigger. And I can remember standing in the back of the room with tears streaming down my face because I knew what she said was true. And I felt totally hopeless. You know, if that was what it was, then where's the hope for me? I realized today it wasn't hopeless that I felt. It was powerless. It really was powerless. That's the real description of powerlessness for me. And I knew I was incapable of abstaining. I couldn't do it. So I went home, I got down on my knees and I said, God, if you want me to abstain, you have to take away this obsession. Because if I have the obsession, the food's going to go in my mouth. And the obsession was removed for a while. Nothing lasted forever. But, you know, the next 2 years were mostly abstaining, but some slips, which, you know, we had to call breaks and abstinence. You had to raise your hand if you were in your first 30 days, because that's what they did in AA. So that's what they were doing in Los Angeles at that time in OA. And I laughingly call my last binge, which was October 11th, 1976, was three Oreo cookies after dinner. And I called a friend, to me today, that's not a binge, but it was the last time. And I called a friend of mine who I'd become very close to, and I still consider to be very wise. And she said to me, Susie, aren't you sick and tired of starting over? And a light bulb went off. And I don't think I could have verbalized it then, but I realized that my perfectionism, I didn't even know I had that character defect, but it was like a Siamese twin of my compulsive overeating. You know, if I had to be perfect, I couldn't do it. And so I decided that night that I was never starting over again, that I didn't have to be perfect. I had to abstain. I couldn't call a binge, you know, abstaining. I got that. But if I had some deviation from my food plan, that didn't mean that I was a failure and that I had to start over again. And that's what started me on this road that takes me to where I am today. I mean, it's actually quite miraculous. That was the beginning of my abstinence. I was hypoglycemic at that time. So I was eating six times a day with nothing in between. That was really hard for me. I'm not and haven't been hypoglycemic for a really long time. Today, I don't eat in between meals for the most part, unless, you know, it's going to be a 12 o'clock lunch and a 9 o'clock dinner or something like that. You know, I don't eat in between meals. Because snacks to me, I'm starting to realize, I'm still learning about how I use food and how food uses me. Snacks to me in a way feels like free food, like it doesn't count. I don't know why, it's like ridiculous. I know intellectually that that's not true. But over the course of these years, I have had many different food plans. I can't even begin to remember them all. It took me many years to accept that I really did have a problem with sugar and bread and pasta and food like that. I ate them in my abstinence. I did not binge on them. I did not overeat on them. But what I realized after I stopped eating them, which was probably 15, 20 years ago, was that I thought about it all the time. I may not have eaten them all the time. I may not have overeaten them, but I thought about it all the time. And if I ate it on Tuesday, then I wanted it again on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, I wanted it twice. You know, normal or whatever that it means amounts, but it just really took me a long time. And I, you know, I went to a nutritionist about 20 years ago, and she gave me some very valid reasons for giving up gluten and sugar. And I remember thinking to myself, I've eaten enough for more than my lifetime anyway. You know, it's like, I don't need that. It's so interesting to me, people in the real world, when I tell them I don't eat, you know, all these things, they say, well, what do you eat? Like, that's all there is to eat. Like, well, there's vegetables and there's fish and there's meat and there's fruit. And, you know, there's all kinds of things you can eat without eating those things. And I also know that there are people who eat those things in abstinence. And I'm fine with that. That's, you know, that's each person gets to decide their own food plan. And I, one of the things I really love about OA is it's evolved to that place where we can each choose what works for us. So back to 1976, I met my current husband in 1976. He's not in OA, but I actually met him at an OA birthday party event in January in Los Angeles. In those days, we had a one-day marathon, and that year we had a talent show at night. And he played the piano for a friend of mine who, and I wanted to hear her sing. I'd never heard her sing before. And that's how we met. So I, you know, I had no idea that that night that I met him, I had no interest, none whatsoever. As far as I was concerned, I didn't want to ever have anything to do with men again. It's always a good time to meet somebody when you feel that way, because there's no expectations. So we started dating. He got involved with my kids right away. And because of him and a few other things, I was able to change my behavior towards my children. I struggled so much. My parents were both hitters. My father used to hit me with a belt. My mother would sometimes hit me with a ruler or a brush, although she denied it, but she did. And I was a hitter too. But, you know, if the kids that did something and it annoyed me, I might just slap them, you know, and I yelled a lot. And I remember my, Joe said, Joe's my husband, not this Joe, but the other Joe, the one that's upstairs, said to me, how do you think your kids feel when you hit them? And I knew exactly how they felt because it's how I felt. And I said, well, they want to hit me back. And he said, yeah, and they can't because you're their mother. And they were 5 and 7 at the time. I never hit him again after that. You know, he wasn't the first man I dated who said something to me about the way I treated my children. I was ready. Prior to that, I had been at a retreat, and I really was trying to find some people in OA who were single parents who had custody of their kids, and I wasn't able to find any. But there was this woman who had raised her children as a single mother before OA, but she had a great program. And I was talking to her at the retreat about the stuff that I was doing and how I, you know, couldn't seem to stop. And she looked at me in the eyes and she said, Susie, you fucked up. What are you going to do about it? It was like the first time someone was honest with me. Everybody else had said, oh, you're doing the best you can, pat, pat, pat. And as long as they said, you're doing the best you can, I kept doing it. And I realized, so when I look back on all that, you know, stuff that happened, I realized that I was blaming my mother for everything that had happened bad in my life. And therefore, it was my fault what was happening with my kids and how they were acting. And then after the blame came the guilt. And the guilt immobilized me. You know, feeling guilty meant I didn't have to do anything. Now, I learned in a way that you make amends. So I made amends, but I never amended my behavior. And when I was able to let go of the guilt and realize that, and that's what that woman said to me was, you have responsibility. You have to take responsibility for your actions. That's not the same as guilt. So I was able to take responsibility for my actions and finally able to stop behaving that way, stop yelling at them all the time. I can remember one time my son said to me, my younger one said to me, can't you just spank me and get it over with? So it was whatever punishment I was giving him, you know, you're grounded for 3 days or whatever it was. I'm so grateful. I am so grateful that I was able to change that behavior. I can't even imagine what my relationship with my children would be like if I hadn't changed that behavior. So, you know, the big book says that there's that, or maybe it's the A, 12 and 12. I know I read it in some AA literature that sometimes we need outside help. And I was one of those. I needed outside help. I went to therapy. We went to family therapy. All of that made a huge difference. It took me a while. My children are 54. I'm aging him. I'm 20 years older than he is. He's 54 and 52. And, you know, in their teenage years, there was a lot of, you know, teenager stuff that happened. It was difficult. You know, I learned how to pick my battles. They got into young adulthood. They still looked up to me in some ways. They would call me and ask me for advice. And then they got to this certain age where they really became adults and they didn't need me anymore. That transition was really difficult for me. I've gotten over it by now, of course, but, you know, it's like my older son's been with his husband for 30 years. You know, when he's got something going on in his life, he goes to his husband. That's what he's supposed to do. You know, when my younger son has something going on in his life, he goes to his wife or he goes to some friends he has, some really close friends. And that's what I did. I didn't go to my mother, you know, when I was an adult. So, but I am still now at the ages that we are learning how to have relationships with them that are satisfying. You know, it's like my mom was the kind of person that she would call me and complain to me because Brian, my younger one, never called her. And I'd say, well, call him. He never calls me either. You know, if you want to talk to him, call him. Well, she had this idea in her head that, well, he's the grandson. He's supposed to call me. So, you know, here I am. I have two grandsons. I have two sons. I would love for my son to call me more often, my younger son. You know, he does call me once in a while, usually when he's driving from Tampa back to Palm Beach, you know, he'll call me, but he has to keep himself awake. So what I started to do is just text him every once in a while and say, just thinking about you, want you to know I love you, or just thinking about you, hope everything's going great, you know, and like every once in a while when I do that, he'll pick up the phone and call me. And that's not why I'm doing it. It wouldn't work if that was why I was doing it. So the relationship I have with my kids is very precious to me in very many ways. And my grandchildren, I've struggled some with staying in touch with them because I lived in California and they lived in Florida. Their other grandparents, my daughter-in-law's parents, were 10 minutes away and I was 3,000 miles away. And I struggled mightily with jealousy about their relationship with their other grandparents and how do I maintain a relationship with them when I'm so far away. And I did a lot of traveling to be with them. Now that they're on the cusp of adulthood, you know, and we have all this new technology, which we didn't have when they were young, you know, we do FaceTime, we text. You know, I get that texting is probably the preferred method of communication. My younger grandson is a senior in high school and he's getting college acceptance and rejections at this point. You know, he's waiting to find out all the schools he's been accepted to so he can figure out which one he's going to go to. So every once in a while, I check in with him and see how he's doing. And, you know, he's not terribly talkative. It's really hard to talk with him on the phone or even on FaceTime. He's the kid who says, you know, and say, what happened in school today? Nothing. You know, he's that kid. My older grandson, we can be on FaceTime or on the phone for an hour. I mean, he likes to talk. He's very knowledgeable. We talk about current events and he tells me about his classes in college. And it's, you know, but he's not going to pick up the phone and call me unless it's Mother's Day or my birthday. So I need to make the effort. And it's just like I told my mother, if you want to talk to him, pick up the phone. You know, if I want to have that relationship. And I was struggling with that until, I don't know, maybe about 6-8 months ago. And I realized that I get busy with my life and I forget to reach out. And I was talking to some friends and they said, you know, what can I do? And I thought, well, you know, I have a biweekly call with a friend of mine. I call her twice a week. And we just check in with, you know, on things like, are you exercising and meditating? And, you know, and I have it in my calendar. I thought, why didn't I think of that? So I put in my calendar. I have all these people that I want to stay in touch with. So I put them in my calendar. So I stay in touch with them. It's like, it's not a crutch. It's a tool, you know, it's a great, you know, so I have, you know, check in with David, check in with Jacob. I probably should add my younger son in there. So, you know, the relationships that I have today are really a gift from God in this program. I was able to heal my relationships with my parents before they died so that when they did die, I had no regrets. I knew that my parents loved me in the best way they knew how, and that the things that they did that hurt me were not done to hurt me. They didn't know any better. They did the best they could. And part of, you know, it's like when my dad died, I was comforted to know that he knew I loved him. He really did. And I knew that he loved me. And that, you know, that's a gift, a real gift from this program. Same with my mother and with my sister, who's still alive. But, you know, she knows I love her. And I know she loves me. And we live 3,000 miles away from each other, which hasn't always been that way. But, you know, we find ways to connect and stay in touch. So in Los Angeles, I left Los Angeles in 1988. So I was in OA 22 years at the time. I had been involved in service. I had been the program chair for the birthday party. I was the co-chair for 2 years of the birthday party. I was involved in intergroup. I went to region. I went to world service. And then I moved to the Bay Area. And I started going to my intergroup up in Marin County where I lived. And they didn't have a region rep and they didn't have a world service delegate. And I volunteered. And I didn't volunteer because I thought it would be a great thing to do. It's because I wanted to see my friends. It's like, well, if I go to region, I'll be able to see these people and those people who also go to region. If I go to world service. So, but it really was a great service for me. But what I did do to really get involved was I volunteered to be on a convention committee. I knew I would meet people on a convention committee. And in the Bay Area, there's a lot of different intergroups. So I met people from all over the Bay Area. I live north of San Francisco. I met people from San Francisco, south of San Francisco, from Oakland and Berkeley, and further east than that, and south on that side of the Bay. You know, so we all came together to work on this convention. And I'm still friends with a lot of those people. So service really kept me from going nuts. I mean, I really had a hard time adjusting when I moved to the Bay Area. I really missed my Los Angeles friends. I missed my Los Angeles meetings. They did not know how to do meetings right in Marin County. I mean, come on, you know, they weren't doing it the way LA was doing it. And I mean, it's kind of like saying AA is the grandfather. They have to do everything right. It was like, well, LA is where OA was born. So certainly they're doing everything right there. But, you know, after a couple of years, I remember going to a meeting in Los Angeles and saying, this is not right. It's like what you get used to. It's one of the things I love about OA. It doesn't really matter. What matters is we have the same problem and we've come together for a common solution. That's what matters. We're following the traditions. We're working the steps to the best of our ability. What you read at your meeting or the cadence of the closing prayers or, you know, that kind of stuff, that's just different from place to place. That's just a group conscience thing. That's every group is autonomous thing. So I lived in the Bay Area in for 29 years. And so during that period of time, I remember going to region and the region chair, she's actually a really good friend of mine now, but at the time I really didn't like her. She was treating us like children. Now it could have been, we were acting like children. I mean, I can imagine that might be the case. And she wasn't yet a teacher, but she did become a teacher. And I remember I was going to, this was 1990. I was going to run for region chair that year because I thought I would be much better than she was. And I don't have an ego, though, really. So at conference that year, the region 2 trustee ran for general service trustee position and was elected. So the region 2 trustee position was vacant. I never once for a moment thought that I was qualified to be a trustee. A number of people including the former trustee from the region and other trustees, said you should submit your application. And I remember thinking, me? What do I have to offer? It's like, all right, let me think about this. I came into the conference room before all the meetings started one morning, and I wrote a dialogue with God. And the bottom line of the message was, you don't need to know what the answer is. Just submit your application and leave the rest to me. And I didn't submit my application thinking I'd be the only one, so therefore I would get appointed, because there have been times when there's only been one person submitting and they didn't get appointed. So it wasn't that. It seemed to be where God was leading me. And that service, I was trustee for 5 years. It was one of the best things I ever did for myself. I may have done something, one or two things for OA, but really it was the best thing I ever did for myself. I learned how to facilitate meetings. I learned how to speak in front of people. I had to deal with conflicts. There was a huge conflict in the LA Intergroup at the time between Howe and OA, and we had meetings and I was facilitating them and go back and have all these meetings with the board of trustees. And, you know, but I did some really good things. I went to Mexico and we submitted a motion to bring Mexico into the region. We brought Mexico into the region. When I left there, my self-esteem had gone from wherever it was. It certainly wasn't where it was when I came into OA, but really improved dramatically. Just because I learned some skills there, but I also learned I had skills I had no idea that I had. And I changed careers based on that. It was an absolutely incredible experience for me. I'm not ready to do it again, but it was really, it's a lot of time, a big time commitment. And after that, I took a year off and then I became region chair for 4 years. And then I took a couple of years off and then I became a convention chair. And then it was like, okay, I'm done. I've done all the service I ever dreamed I ever wanted to do above the group or intergroup level. And I went back to doing that kind of service. I worked on the retreat committee for my intergroup. I was intergroup chair for a while. And, you know, I did meeting service. I was secretary and whatever else, you know, whatever all those positions are. We're into 2000. I don't remember what year it was. It was 8 years ago or something like that. My son and his husband moved to Charlotte. So he'd been living in Los Angeles. So when I would come to LA, I could see him pretty easily. I would come to LA for Thanksgiving. We'd have Thanksgiving together because my other son, as I said before, was in Florida. And now he's on the other side of the country. I'm getting older. I never had family in the Bay Area, but at least I had my son in California. And if there was ever an emergency, it was a short plane ride. And I started to feel really, I missed him. You know, it's like when I moved away from LA, he was only 19 years old. And it was the best thing I could have done was to move away from him. But he'd grown up and I'd grown up. So the first year that they lived here, we did an annual winter trip to Florida. So we did our time in Florida, and then we came to Charlotte to visit with Rick and Jeff, and I fell in love with the place. I remember, you know, they were driving us around and showing us different things, and I thought, I could live here. I really could live here. And I never thought I'd leave California. I never thought I'd make a move like this. I certainly never thought I'd move across country. But I hadn't lived near Rick for 29 years, and I hadn't lived near Brian for 25 years. And I wanted to be closer to my kids. You know, it was quite the discussions my husband and I had on this, because he did not want to leave. And it's one of the best things I've ever done. Is to move here. I am so happy to be close to my son and my son-in-law. We see each other about once a week, 10 minutes. We take care of each other in a lot of different ways. And I'm also on the same time zone as my son and my grandkids. It's easier for me to get to them for holidays and special occasions and things like that. I felt so disconnected in some ways from my children, and being here has really changed that. And so, you know, we moved here 5 years ago. We arrived on December 31st, 2017. I had already gone to some meetings here. I already made some connections. I was invited to go to Intergroup, and I went to Intergroup to support my friend who was the Intergroup chair. I became the vice chair, then I became the chair. And then they needed someone to go to region. I never thought I would do this service again, but I went to region as a region rep from my inner group. And the first person I met, most of you guys won't know who she is, but Lee and Joe will, is Pam Gleason. She had moved into region 8, and she was had been the bylaws chair, and she had just been elected as the vice chair of the region. So she asked me on my very first assembly if I would chair the bylaws committee. And so I did. I chaired the bylaws committee. And then when the current chair's term was up, I ran for chair, and here I am. I'm now the chair of Region 8. So I'm really enjoying doing this level of service again. It's different because I'm different. I'm older. So I have more time, but less energy. So it works out perfectly, you know. My memory's was never great, and it's not as good as it was, but, you know, I have support. I have a great board. You know, it's been really something. And as the region chair, I get to go to conference. And I'll tell you how badly I want to go to conference. My husband and I have a trip planned that we planned 2 years ago. We're going to Belgium and up the coast of Amsterdam on a river cruise. I'm coming back 2 days before I have to leave for conference. So it's a 6-hour time difference. And then I have a 2 more hour time difference to go to Albuquerque. But I really want to go. I want to be there. And I don't know if I'm going to see, I mean, Joe, if you come, I'll see someone I know from the distant past. But I don't know if I'm going to see anybody I know outside of the people I know from my region, whom many of whom I've not met in person because we've been doing everything on Zoom. So it's really great to know that we can actually be in person together. So my life today, I live in the house that I always dreamt of and never thought I could ever have. And that's as a result of selling a house in California and buying a house in North Carolina, way cheaper in North Carolina. My relationship with my husband is beyond anything I could have ever imagined or hoped for. And, you know, we've been married for it'll be 43 years this year. And it took us a long time, a lot of struggles, a separation, a lot of couples counseling. But we finally have learned to how to be honest with each other, how to talk, you know, how to listen. I'm not a great listener, but I'm learning how to be, I'm still learning and practicing being a better listener. We're very different. We don't have a lot in common in a lot of ways, but there are things we do. We're great travelers. We travel very well together. It's great for me because he's the planner and I hate to plan. So that works out really well. And, you know, I can remember when the kids, and particularly when they were teenagers, and there was like all we ever talked about was this problem or that problem. I remember saying to him, when the kids are out of the house, what are we going to talk about? We've figured it out. You know, he's not in OA, like I said, but he's always supported my OA activities. All those years, the years that I was trustee, I was traveled a lot. I was away a lot. He never once complained. When I told him I wasn't going to run for another 3 years, I could have done 8 years instead of 5. And I told him I wasn't going to run for that another 3-year term. He said, oh, I'm so glad. But he never would have denied me that ever. He never would have told me he was unhappy with it. So I've been, you know, he wasn't the man that I was dreaming about, but God knew better than I did. You know, I'm so lucky and so blessed to have him. And I feel, you know, like, how come I've kept coming back all these years? I found here in OA the family I always wanted when I was growing up. I always wanted a big family. So now I have this big family. And no matter where I go, what language is being spoken, you know, we are family. You know, we're just family. And there's an understanding that goes beyond words when you're with another compulsive overeater in recovery. We just get each other. And I'm friends with people I would never have been friends with in the real world, whatever that means, because of this commonality. I've learned how to disagree with someone without being disagreeable. I've learned that we can be on two different sides of an issue, like at conference, and still go have lunch together. You know, it's just like there's a peace and acceptance. Nobody, I don't have to control everything, and I don't have to be controlled. It's just like we just can have an honest discussion. We may not have the same opinion, and that's okay. So the gifts are, I can't even begin to tell you all the gifts. I've told you a lot, but there's so much more, but the time is up. So I'm really grateful to be a part of OA for 56 years, to be abstaining for 46 years, to be able to share like this. I mean, Zoom is the greatest thing ever. You know, here you guys is meeting in Texas and I'm in North Carolina and there's someone from Australia. We have people from California and we have people from Connecticut and all over the place. And, you know, because we want to all be together and share our recovery. And I'm so grateful for that. Thank you so much for being here tonight, for listening.
Thank you very much, Susan, for sharing. It really was great. And, You influenced my life a lot, and I want you to know that. Thank you. Okay, we give out a desire chip here.